ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on the American Freedom Radio Network 5 days a week, 2 hours a day, for your daily dose of comedy and conspiracy. It's the lighter side of genocide. Because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go freaking nuts. And my very special guests today... Yes, and I do realize I call everybody my very special guests because everybody's so special. Anthony Peake, who's kind of a dude who knows about the science of life after death. I've had him on the show before. And somebody I have not had on the show before, who we'll introduce first, Thomas Campbell. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Vinny. Glad to be here.
Do you just let us know what your expertise is, my son?
My expertise? Well, by profession, I'm a physicist. Okay, specialized in nuclear physics, but that with a day job, my night job was working in a lab with Bob Monroe studying consciousness. So that's really why I'm here, not as a physicist so much as a student of consciousness.
And all right,
yeah.
Well, it helps actually to be kind of on that that ironic twist, don't you think?
Well, I think it helps a whole lot to have both going at the same time. You can understand consciousness much better if you have a good basis in science, and you can, you know, the two work well with each other. You can understand actually physics better with a good basis in consciousness and metaphysics as well.
But, of course, there are those, of course, who are absolutely and utterly in denial that consciousness has anything to do with science of any kind, and they're simply... very close-minded about it. I presume you know of these kind of people.
I've met one or two of them in my time, yes.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate incident. Anthony Peake is also with us. Welcome, Anthony.
Hello there. Hi, how are you doing? How are you doing, Tom? Nice to be linked up with you again.
Yeah, doing fine, Anthony. Yeah, nice that we get to talk together another time.
Absolutely.
Mm-mm-mm. And Anthony, would you explain to the audience just a little bit about what you do as well?
Right, my area is rather similar to Tom's in the sense that I'm actually trying to do the science of consciousness and the science of bringing together physics, consciousness, and just general perceptions, really, as to how we perceive reality and what reality is. What is particularly interesting is that Tom and I have discussed issues a couple of times in the past, and I'm very much moving towards Tom's position on a lot of things, which is the idea that consciousness is the prime source of everything, and physical matter is very much a manifestation of consciousness rather than the other way around.
Now, apparently Wired magazine came out with an article not too long ago saying that they found evidence out there in the stars or something like that, that all of this universe and everything that we see that's physical is in fact probably a computer program.
Yes, I would agree with that. That's where my position starts as well, is that this is a virtual reality. And that you've seen that in Wired, but you know, when I first wrote these books, you didn't see that anywhere. There was Fredkin, and there was maybe a fellow over in England who thought that was a good idea, a virtual reality. But now, every week or two, I see another... you know, scientific paper on why virtual reality is really the best physics. So it's a thing that's coming. It's an idea whose time has come, it seems. It's beginning to be a landslide in favor of that because it's just better physics. You can do physics problems better on that assumption than anything else. And, of course, once you take the next step after that, which is, well, okay, it's a big computer, then it's like, well, who's programming and, you know, why and how and that sort of stuff. And then those answers lead you to consciousness, which then leads you to metaphysics, philosophy, and all the rest of that stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree with Tom there as well, because I've found this, that it's suddenly very much in vogue now, this idea of the computer simulation. But I think, as Tom was saying there, I mean, I think it's Nick Bostrom that Tom was very much mentioning there. Yeah. And it's been very much, you know, an area of interest of quite a few of us for quite a few years now. But I'm delighted to see that it is now getting more into the mainstream, because as Tom says, you know, this is one of the things that effectively explains everything. You know, it's a total theory rather than a selective explanator of exactly what experience is.
Now, what do you say to skeptics who would say, oh, you guys are just crazy?
Well, I would...
Before you answer that, I went to a skeptics meeting one time and they were very, very positive about GMO food. And I told them about an article that said that Monsanto doesn't serve GMO food in its cafeterias. And they... And they had a look for the article, and they say, oh, well, this is a skeptics meeting, and the websites that this is on are like beforeitsnews.com and that kind of thing. And I say, oh, really? Is that what a skeptic is? Somebody who only believes the mainstream take on things and says that everything else is BS without looking at it.
Well, you know, Vincent, there's only three requirements for a skeptic. One, they have to have a belief. Two, a mouth. And three, an audience. Nothing else is required. So, that puts a lot of
brains
people
in the
skeptic
game. Okay. Well, anyway, continue on with your explanation of what you would do. In fact, that's a good thing to say to the skeptics or everything. You've got a mouth, an opinion, and an audience, but that's all you got, mate. Sorry.
Yeah, that's all that's required. And, I'm a big favor of skepticism. Matter of fact, one of my bylines phrase I keep repeating over and over in my book is you need two things to find truth. One is open-mindedness, and the two is skepticism. Because if you only have one of those but not the other, you're in trouble. So it takes both of those to find truth. So if I run into skeptics, if they were science types, if these were people who actually had, degrees in physics or other sciences, I would basically... challenge them on the basis of physics, in that virtual reality just answers more questions. It's better physics. It explains more things with fewer problems than does the other model. We have problems with what happened before the Big Bang. Where did that Big Bang come from? Our whole universe, which according to them is the only reality that there is, well, it didn't exist until after the Big Bang. Where'd all that energy get wadded up in that little point that could go bang and create this universe if there's nothing else other than this universe? You see, there's a little problem there. A universe doesn't create itself, does it? We've got this universe that is expanding. Expanding into what? If this universe is all the reality there is, then what is it that this universe is expanding into? You see, there's lots of problems like this, and that's just a couple of them. You have other problems with... things that places like Paralabs have been doing research for the last 30 years in mind affecting matter. They have people using their intent to modify random distributions, robots that are wobbling around on tape. There's lots of things. They've done this in lots of different ways. Their results are better than 1 in a billion. I should put it this way. It's less than 1 in a billion that their results could have just been circumstance, just good luck that they just happened to guess the answers right, so they have huge statistical significance. And, this concept of virtual reality, along with my concept of consciousness, can explain to them why they get those results. How is it that mind can affect matter? How come there is such thing as a placebo effect, where you tell somebody something like, oh, this pill will cure, your problem, and 30 or 40%, it actually cures the problem. Or makes them a lot better. Not just makes them think they're feeling better, but actually, cures their problem. So we have all of these, effects. We know how intent modifies reality. I mean, these experiments have been done over and over and over. You tell a teacher and a bunch of kids that this is the dumb class, and that's the smart class, and guess what? Years down the line, those kids in the dumb class aren't doing as well as those kids in the smart class, and there wasn't any difference at all between them. They were just randomly picked. How come that is? If mind doesn't, if matter just is kind of in charge of everything, right, and you are just what you are, and what would a little talk have to do with that? Well, intent changes reality, and there's a mechanism for how that works. It's just part of the way reality works.
That's what I would say
to the skeptic, is look at the facts.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine was inducted into the Aeronautical Engineering School of Auckland University, and they told him and everybody else that you're the smartest people in this school. Everybody else is dumb compared to you, and yada, yada, yada. And, it's interesting. People who go into incredibly high fields like that, who get told that they're really brilliant and that they're better than everybody else, go on to be a whole real pack of douchebags who think they're better than everybody else.
Yeah, they just come away with that assumption that if they don't know it and they don't understand it, then it couldn't possibly exist or be true.
Yeah, and I love the explanation of the Big Bang. Everything came from nothing. What?
Yeah, sounds mystical, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think making Shiite Muslim up. Anthony, yes, your take?
I was going to say that it's exactly the same when we start discussing the idea of exactly what consciousness is. You know, the idea that I have behind my eyes and somewhere I feel located inside my head, a conscious being that reacts to reality. Now, effectively, again, the Australian philosopher David Chalmers very much calls this the hard problem of science. The idea, how is it that basically inanimate matter, electrical impulses within inorganic and organic material can bring about the concept of a three-dimensional human being with hopes, fears, anticipations, the whole thing. Now, modern science cannot explain this. It's the hard problem. And, of course, until we realize that there is a consciousness that exists, we've got a problem. Now, you talk to a lot of the real arch-skeptics, the people that are known as the materialist reductionists. They will turn around to you and they will say, well, because we can't quantify it, because consciousness does not have extension in space, it therefore doesn't exist. And there are people like Daniel Dennett and the Churchlands and various other neurologists who come across with these ideas that there is nothing. I mean, Dan Dennett, amazingly enough, in one of his books, turns around and says that there really is nothing going in. There really is just a ghost in the machine. It's an illusion. We are fooling ourselves into believing we're conscious. My question to Dennett has always been, and I'd love to ask him this, to be fooled, you have to be aware of the fact that you're being fooled. If there's nothing there, how can anything be fooled if there's nothing there to be fooled in the first place?
The world is full of paradoxes like that, isn't it?
Also,
here's another thing. I've got this old saying, right, guys, that the man who thinks he knows everything obviously knows nothing. And the man who thinks that he knows nothing probably knows enough. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the idea, isn't it, that we meet these people all the time, and I don't know if Tom is the same, but when I lecture and talk, there is always the wise guy who knows everything. And the one thing I'm amazed with is my amazing ignorance of so many subjects. And it really is true. The more you know, the less you know. I think it was Socrates that made that statement, and it is so very true. It's like, as well, modern science has this preoccupation with naming things. You know, the idea is because we call it dark matter, we've explained it. We call it the Big Bang. Oh, we now have explained it because it's a Big Bang. But, of course, all this is a cult of naming. It's a cult of control. But the reality is that we don't understand it. And this is what's amazing about Tom's books, you know, that Tom very much goes into the physics of exactly how his arguments come together. And I'm trying to come from the neurological side. And effectively, Tom and I are kind of meeting in the middle. I'm going from the neurology, he's coming from the big issues, and I'm coming from the small ones. And there's a meeting of minds. But I think Tom would agree with me that we're on our way to finding out. And I think that probably people like Tom and myself are totally open-minded, but not to be open-minded enough that your brains fall out.
Well, in fact, there was an interesting video that was explaining the concept of open-mindedness, and a dude was sitting outside somebody else's house, and there was a desk lamp, and the desk lamp was shining on a wispy kind of a curtain of some description, and there was an image projected on the wall of a ghost-like figure, and he was trying to convince his neighbor that he saw a ghost, and the neighbor was trying to convince him, no, you didn't see a ghost, you just didn't know what it was you were seeing because you didn't actually really have a look at it. And what I found was very interesting about the point of this video is that it was trying to criticize basically open-mindedness by saying that if you are open-minded, it means you're gullible and you're an idiot and you don't actually research into things. So what is very interesting about Thomas's perspective there when he says you need to be skeptical and open-minded at the same time, you need to allow new information but verify it before you send it downstream, as it were.
Yes, and you know, there's one other ingredient to that. You do have to be skeptical and open-minded, because if you're skeptical and not open-minded, you're trapped with your beliefs. You can't learn anything new, and if you're open-minded but not skeptical, you can walk down any you know, you can be led down any path and not be critical of whether it makes sense or not. But the other thing is you have to be able to live gracefully with uncertainty. That's a very important part of it. Because if you're open-minded, which means you don't jump to conclusions and beliefs and have an answer for every, you know, for everything, you have to realize there's a lot of things you don't know. And when you don't know something, what we do is tend to believe something in that, you know, in that space of that ignorance. We fill that ignorance up. We cover it over with a belief. So now we have a belief that makes us feel better because, oh, we know it. Like, you know, like the naming, it's the same thing. We give it a name and now we feel better because we can convince ourselves we know it. So you have to be able to live gracefully with uncertainty and be in that space where you say, well, you know, a ghost in the living room, well, I don't know, maybe. Let's look into it. And I'll give it, from my past experience, about a 10% chance of being true and about a 90% chance that there's something else going on in there. But let's look into it. And then as you get data, you adjust that percentage from maybe 10 to 90 to maybe 50-50, depending on, you know, whatever. So it's a lifetime's work of trying to reduce that uncertainty, you know, around your skepticism.
Yeah, well, I think you mentioned my three favorite words, which are I don't know. I believe everything I know to be true is probably wrong. I just haven't seen the evidence yet that proves how wrong I am, and I can't wait to. I love being proved wrong because it means I learn something for a change. We'll be right back after the break with Tom Campbell and Anthony Peake. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the banjo-playing show that's toothless with silver polish on shotguns on a back porch of some description down in Louisiana. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and, incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Hey, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, James Wright from Occupy Freemasonry, I need to give out a quick mention here today, is living in his car at the moment. He hasn't had a shower in a couple of days. He is hungry, and he is in real trouble. So if you can send some money to him, if you go to facebook.com/Occupy Freemasonry, I think there's a link there to his J Dallas, Texas, J-A-Y Dallas, Texas, at hotmail.com, I think, is his PayPal account. Send him some money, because at the moment he's just having a bum he's having a bum Wi-Fi off of hotel parking lots. And if you can't find that for him, send me the money. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, click donate, and make sure you put a note in there. This is for James Wright to survive. Okay, he's in real trouble. Okay, this is the biggest whistleblower in Freemasonry, like, history, okay, since way back in the day, in real trouble right now because of what he's doing, trying to expose the Supreme Council of the 33rd degree. So, you know, please support him. This is kind of what I try to do all the time, is just support the people who actually really need it, when they really, really need it. So please, ladies and gentlemen, this is deadly freaking serious. Deadly serious. Now, back to the show. My very special guests, Thomas Campbell and Anthony Peake. And we've been having a few laughs over the break. I think Anthony described the last show that we did as getting more bizarre and more bizarre as time goes on. And I think we've kind of started off on a note of the world and reality and the universe is, in fact, a computer program. Let's see how much more bizarre we can get. I think that's quite of a test of character, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, we can do that.
Certainly.
Yeah. Now, in terms of weird things that are unexplained by general science but can be explained by the virtual reality science, is there any examples you guys can flick off?
Oh, sure. Lots of them. Matter of fact, you bring up something that's unexplained, and there's a very good guess that virtual reality and consciousness, just virtual reality by itself, will not explain, everything. But once you understand consciousness and how consciousness works, the two together will explain pretty much everything. We look at the paranormal things, you know, those things get explained. We see, you know, the fellow on YouTube, Dr. Emoto, who has water that he freezes, and he gets happy crystals and he gets ugly crystals based on how he's thinking. It explains things like that. And, I don't know, you name it, and there's an explanation for it. And you go into the physics, things like, let's see, what was it? They have several things there. Well, in quantum mechanics, we just have some new quantum mechanics experiments where they had some particles that indeed get detected, but at the same time they get a diffraction pattern. And that may not mean too much to you if you're not into, you know, double slit physics, but that's something that everybody thought was impossible. But then that's explainable too, just like the Big Bang. When you really understand how the big picture works, then it's easier to see how these other things work. And something more pedestrian, like what about the secret? You know, you use your mind to program the universe to give you what you want. You know, the power of positive thinking, those kinds of things. You know, how does that work? Well, it does work. You know, if you're a very negative person, you end up, you know, living in a very negative world. And if you're a positive person, then things tend to fall to you, what they call it, synchronicity, just when you need them and how you need them. And that's all, you know, part of the way reality works. It's all, you know, part of the process. And we mentioned things like a placebo effect. You know, that's a big mystery, has been for a long time. You know, how does that work? What about psychic healing? How do you heal someone with your mind? Well, there's a mechanism for that. You're just simply using intent to modify probable future reality, because this is not only a virtual reality that's on a computer, but it's a probabilistic virtual reality, not a deterministic reality.
Could I put an example onto that one and then throw it over to Anthony? Have you heard of fireburndoctor.com?
No.
No, this is very interesting. If you take down the number, I think I've got it on my phone here, and you get burned, like badly burned or whatever, you call Fireburn Doctor and you send him a picture or an email or something like that of the burn, and they heal it remotely. Instead of it costing millions of dollars and going through agonizing pain and having horrible disfigurement for the rest of your life, it just goes, it's gone in a couple of hours.
Well, this again is intriguing, because you could say it's an extreme form of the placebo effect, in the sense that, you know, we can do things that we're not really aware of in our everyday consciousness. But I'm very much thinking along the lines of something that Tom mentioned there about the twin slit experiment, and the idea that in some way the act of observation by a conscious being collapses what's called the wave function into a point particle. Now, in my next book, Mindfield, I'm going to be discussing some of the work of Thomas Hertog and Stephen Hawking. And they have come up in 2007 or 2008. They wrote a paper and they presented to the world something called the top-down hypothesis. And in the top-down hypothesis, now remember, this is Stephen Hawking, the world's leading research physicist, and we also have Thomas Hertog, who's a research scientist at CERN. And what they are saying is that, rather like Tom and I both agree with on this, is that everything is already encoded into what I would call the zero point field, or what Tom would call the field, or whatever we like to term it. But effectively, every potentiality is out there. And every decision we make collapses one wave function into one history. But all the other histories are all there. It's effectively the history that you follow. So effectively, you could collapse a wave function in which your hand has been healed. And in which case, that is a wave function collapse. So, and if we are living in a computer simulation, and if that computer simulation has within it encoded every single outcome of every single decision that can possibly be made, like a super-duper first-person DVD game, that's not so irrational and not so strange. The question is, we are not aware enough of being able to manipulate the reality around us in the way that possibly we might be able to do collectively, as more and more people become aware of the fact that consciousness is prime and reality is secondary, or physicality is secondary. I don't know what Tom's opinions would be on that.
Well, Tom, I would agree with the basics of it. It is true that in potentiality, all the things that are possible, all the things that could happen are enumerated in the sense of, you know, here's something that could happen and here's the probability that it will happen. So we have this thing called future probability database that gives us everything that could potentially happen and its probability. But that doesn't mean that all of these various probable realities do exist, in fact. That's a tremendous amount of overhead, if you will, in this big computer that we're talking about. That's an awful lot of computing to do, and it really doesn't have a lot of value. It doesn't give you anything back. It's much easier just to do it kind of in real time, that you compute the probabilities as people use their free will to make, you know, to make decisions. Now, the reason that, scientists, physicists have gotten into this many worlds theory is because, one, they have a sense that reality is deterministic, and therefore you have to determine everything, and you're just picking among the things that are already determined. And that's not really the case. I see it as a system that's based on free will, and that how that wave function collapses depends on what you do and the choices you make, and you have that free will. So it's all kind of a just-in-time, real-time program, if you will, as opposed to everything that's possible gets computed, and then we just go through this big matrix and select the, you know, select the reality that we want. That just seems like there's so much overhead and there's, and just, you know, not necessary to go there. It works just as well without all of that huge amount of computational resources involved.
I remember Tom, when you mentioned this, and we were discussing this when we had one of our interviews a few years ago, and it really profoundly affected me when you were using the analysis and the idea that the reality program, for want of a better word, is collapsed as you look at it. In other words, behind your head now, it doesn't need to be rendered in your universe effectively because you're not looking at it, unless I've misunderstood that. But as I understood that, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Now, it's just like the, you know, The Sims or the World of Warcraft or any other virtual reality you have. Everything isn't rendered all the time. Things are rendered by sending data streams out to individual customers. Individual players get a data stream that render what those players are looking at. So if you are not looking at what's behind you, then what's behind you, the computer doesn't have to render that for you. Now, if there's somebody else that is looking at that, then the computer has to render that for them, you see?
So basically, it's kind of like, I can only deal with what's in front of me. We'll cross that bridge till we come to it in a cosmic kind of way. And I was just thinking, as you guys were talking about this, about, you know, you mentioned if you're living positive and things will happen to you exactly when you need them. And for some reason, it reminded me of Andrew Jackson, I think he might have been a former president of the United States, but he got rid of the American bank type of thing, like the precursor to the Fed, and that was his one great life achievement. And he had a number of assassination attempts on his life. One in particular was when somebody came up to try and kill him, and they had not one but two pistols, and both of them misfired.
Yeah,
you know, I was just thinking about that as you were saying it. And I've got this perspective on reality myself, is that, as you said, Thomas, it's actually the decisions that we make that really make a huge difference. And I feel that perception is sort of a peripheral difference. Like it can make a change, sure, but it doesn't change things really entirely physically. Like, you can't create everything that happens in front of you. There's a framework, and there's decision making, and there's personal responsibility to go into it as well. It's not one or the other, it's everything altogether.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's the way it works is that you modify the future, you know, the probable future, let's put it that way. There's all these things that could happen, and what does happen, you help create what happens. You help make your reality several ways. And one way is that your intent changes the probability. So that's how you heal. You know, you talk about healing it's an intent that they look at that hand and they intend that it heal. And that intent modifies the probable reality of what's going to happen on that hand. It's sort of like that. That's the same thing that's going on with the placebo effect. The placebo effect isn't some kind of, charlatan's effect, you know, some mystical thing. The placebo effect is there just because that's the way consciousness works. Intent modifies probability. Now, let's say there's something that a lot of people are thinking very differently about. Well, some people are pushing probability this way, some are pushing probability that way. You know, things happen because we, the people, basically create it that way. You know, you look at this world and say, why is this world so messed up and so violent and so crazy? Well, it's because that's us, you know. That's the way we, the people, are. We're messed up. We're a little violent. We're crazy. So that's what we get because we create that for ourselves. You know, it's not that we're not here suffering, you know, unneedlessly. We're suffering because that's the way we are. You know, I'm not talking about us individually, but us as a species. You know, we're kind of all in this together, and everything is netted. Every consciousness is connected to every other consciousness. We're always in communications, and space and time make very little difference. So it doesn't matter that those people healing hands are on the other side of the planet or on another planet. It really doesn't matter because, you know, space is not real. Space is virtual.
Yeah, because this is a very important point, you know, that one of the areas that is still amazingly little known within the general public is the concept of non-locality. And again, non-locality was effectively proven back in 1981 in a very famous experiment done by a guy called Alan Aspect at the University of Paris Institute of Optics, where they proved something called the Einstein-Rosen-Podolsky experiment, or the thought experiment. And without going into any great detail about this, effectively what this meant was that everything is, once things have been entangled, whether subatomic particles or anything else, they can then instantaneously communicate with each other. Now, funnily enough, and Tom, I don't know if I'd mentioned this to you, but a couple of years ago, I had coffee with Professor Jeff Forshaw, who's one of Britain's leading particle physicists, one of the youngest as well. He's the professor of particle physics at Manchester University, where they split the atom. In fact, I met him in the very same building. And we had coffee. And over coffee, quite by chance, we were just discussing the EPR paradox and the Aspect experiment and the Bell inequality. And he turned around to me and he said, of course, we now know that every electron in the universe knows the position of every other electron. Now, sit back and think about that for a second. This effectively means that the universe is, in effect, a singularity, which means that everything is a singularity, which means it's all part of a great universal thing, which is one single thing. And funnily enough, one of the guys I'm going to be interviewing on my own radio station in a few weeks' time is Professor Bernard Haish, who's an American astrophysicist. And Haish has come out with a book called The God Theory. And in this, he's saying exactly the same thing. And of course, it's exactly what... we've run out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that is very interesting. If all the electrons know where each other is in the universe, then surely all the protons know where the rest of it is. And I think this is also why morons all cluster together. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
Black sunrise, black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide because the world's so full of chaos and madness and unexplainable things. If you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. Now, there's a lot of things that happen in this world that you don't think is possible, and yet they happen anyway. And Tom was saying over the break that in a probabilistic reality, anything is possible. And I'm of the opinion that in a cannibalistic reality, anyone is edible. Anyway, we were talking about Anthony. You had a wee story about your wife falling down the stairs or something?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in my book, The Labyrinth of Time, I deal with the illusion of time and the idea of what time is psychologically. But one of the incidents that I describe in the book, I found very difficult to understand in any objective way. And what happened was I was sitting at my computer. And again, if anybody's interested in this, if you go onto my Facebook page, if you go onto Anthony Peak on Facebook and you go onto my video, there's a video that will show the distance I moved when this occurred. But I was sitting at my computer and suddenly I heard a scream come from upstairs. And I thought to myself, oh, it's my wife. She's upstairs. She's found a spider in the bathroom. She's going crazy. But something, I sensed something was wrong. So I suddenly found myself running from the study, the 10 or so yards to the bottom of our staircase, because it's a very straight staircase. And as I got to the staircase, I saw my wife in mid-air coming down the stairs. And she'd lost her footing. And when the scream she had done, she told me, was when she lost her footing. I was at the bottom of the stairs and I caught her. Now, had I not caught her, she would have smashed her head on the side of a door and she would have probably killed herself. Now, we were discussing this just off air now, and Tom has a wonderful explanation for this, which that is the wonderful lead-in for Tom to give his My Big Toe explanation of this.
Well, you know, we have this belief in an objective causality. You know, everything is caused by something objective going on, and that's why these sorts of things seem impossible. You couldn't have possibly gotten there in time had you just started getting up out of your chair or being aware of the problem when she first lost her balance. Because unless you were sitting at the bottom of the stairs, you know, you couldn't have done that, because there's only probably a fraction of a second between losing your balance and, you know, being, like you say, in midair. And you're 10, 15 feet away sitting in a chair. It takes you a while to think, what's going on? Oh, that's a scream. Maybe it's a spider. I think I'll get up out of my chair. You know, all that takes time, and it wouldn't work out. So you say, that was just impossible. Well, it's nothing is impossible. Well, let me not say that. Almost nothing is impossible in a probabilistic reality, in a virtual reality. So here's a virtual reality. That scream you get is just something in your data stream. Remember, we mentioned that before, that what your reality is just the data stream you're getting from the computer. You're not, you're not in an objective reality. You're in a virtual reality. So you get this scream ahead of time. Why? Because if you didn't get it ahead of time, you wouldn't be able to catch her and save her life. So the system gives you a scream in your data stream. You hear it, start to react. You have this sense of, this is important. You need to get moving. That goes along with, you know, what's in your data stream. So it all works out. You know, these kind of impossible things happen to people all the time. People put their glasses and car keys down only to find them in places that they haven't been, you know, in the last couple of hours. You know, people, you know, like Vinny was saying, people will drive and suddenly go long distances in short periods of time. You know, they just have a time warp. Well, all of these things are not a problem. There's just a couple of rules about how this reality works to keep it consistent. And one is, you can't violate the rule set. The rule set's basically the rules that create the reality, right? If you're in a World of Warcraft, your character can't jump 100 feet in the air. Why? You know, the rules don't allow that. It's not in the rule set. So you have to abide by the physics here, because that's the rule set. Okay, and secondly is, you can't have any historical inconsistency, right? Now, had there been a bunch of people with movie cameras in Anthony's room watching his wife, taking pictures of his wife coming down the stairs, and at the same time a picture of him sitting at his desk, this couldn't have happened. Because you see, we would have had an inconsistency there. Something, quote, impossible, unquote, would have happened. Well, that's not allowed, but that wasn't like that. Anthony was there, the two of them were alone, you know. Something happens, it's unexplainable, and no big deal. See, it doesn't really cause any problems. So that's part of the thing I call the psi uncertainty principle. It has to do with when these psi events are allowable. So there are rules, there are structure. It's not just anything can happen anytime, but a whole lot of things can happen, you know, a lot of the time when you least expect it. And that's just the nature of reality. I just talked to a lady the other day. She said she had these two paring knives that she used all the time. She'd been using them for years. She set them down on a counter, turned around to do something, turned back. They were gone. She spent hours looking for them. They were gone. They never did return. You know, sometimes they'll show up, like, you know, in the bedroom, or, 2 days later, right exactly where you thought you left them. But, you know, you looked there already 3 or 4 times and they weren't there. You know, these things are common. Once you start talking to people about things like this, you'll find that probably 50% of the people you talk to can tell you about some really weird thing that happened to them once that didn't make any sense. And some of those are just imaginary, but a lot of them are real. You know, everybody isn't walking around a psychotic that, you know, their mind plays tricks on them. Most of these things.
Speak for yourself, Thomas. See, there's a bunch of things that come to mind when you do that. Like this coffee cup that I drink out of every day. For some reason, me and my girlfriend, we look for it. We can't find it, even though it's right there in front of us. I remember one time I was in the kitchen and I was looking desperately for this bottle of milk that I just bought. And I was looking around everywhere. Where the hell is it? Oh my God! I could have sworn I just had it. Where it was in my freaking hand, and I was looking for it for 15 minutes.
Finny, there's an explanation for that. You know, the anthropologist will turn around and give you an explanation for that. And I find it, for instance, I find it amazing that my wife will send me to the fridge to get a cup of some milk, and I'll be looking in the fridge and I can't see it, and suddenly this arm will shoot over my shoulder and grab it, and it's there. And my argument is, I'll say, oh, I couldn't see it because it's white. But apparently the explanation supposedly is, because we are males are gatherer hunters, effectively, because we're only not that long down from the trees, our role is to look into the distance and see wildebeests into the distance so we can go and hunt them. So we're looking in the distance, whereas women are programmed to look closely at a child and look closely at the details of a child's face. So they see detail and we don't. And that's why we can't talk and walk and chew at the same time as males, because we can't multitask in the same way. But it is an intriguing idea. And funnily enough, Tom's example there reminded me of Douglas Adams in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where he mentions that very phenomenon. I remember Tom mentioning that when we spoke once, and I thought it was an amazing analysis. But of course, Douglas Adams argued that, of course, what happened was millions and millions of years ago, there were these beings from the planet Biro, and they upset the Master of the Universe. And the Master of the Universe sent them all across the universe. You're just a diaspora of them. And effectively, they became Biropens. And all pens now want to get back to their home planet. So if you leave them on the desk and you don't look at them, they will jump off the desk because they're trying to get back to their home planet. So that's the explanation.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then there's that too. Huh?
Another couple of examples that I thought of was my mum, and I think I told you guys this over the break. Is there something to do with love here? Because, you know, Anthony, you love your wife, and then suddenly you were there to save her. And my mum loved my...
This.
Yeah, and my mum loved my little brother, and he was dressed in a Batman uniform, and he was trying to jump, or costume, sorry, and he was trying to jump off the garage, and she somehow knew from the other end of the property and ran over there and was there to catch him as he fell. So there's that kind of thing. And me, from my personal experience, I remember this dude, Shane Wenzel, I was involved with, just, you know, this psychopathic scumbag. And on my way to go see him one time, for some reason, I was just telling me, get in the car very, very quickly, like get the key in the door, crack it open, open the door, get in, get the key in the ignition and drive and get the hell out of here. And I was just leaving my house, you know, like there was nobody after me or anything like that. And later on, I think it might've been a couple of weeks later or something like that, I actually wound up exposing this guy for being a brutal, ruthless, sociopathic scumbag. And I did have to get into my car and incredibly quickly, in exactly the same way.
Well, so that kind of thing happens. Yeah, you said, does love have something to do with it? Well, yes, it does, in the sense that I said we all communicate with each other. But, you know, okay, there's what now? 7 billion of us. That's a lot of chatter going on. So we kind of filter out all of that. We don't listen really to all of that. But we do listen to the people who are close to us, the people we love, the people we care most about, the people who are, you know, who want to kill us. You know, the things that are important to us kind of get through that filter. The things that aren't, don't. But we're all connected, and we're all connected all the time. But that's why your mom, you know, hears a child, because, you know, that's her baby, and she knows what's going on in that baby's life if it's something threatening. And, you know, that happens a whole lot. You know, mothers suddenly know, you know, they wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and say, something's wrong with my baby. You know, I mean, that's, you know, I don't know that every mother's had that experience, but it's pretty typical. Mothers know what's going on with that child, and the doctor doesn't have a clue, you know, but mom knows. And that's why we're connected.
I mean, doctors not having a clue is of no surprise to me. Sorry, Anthony, you?
I was going to say that you can extrapolate from that the idea of this whole concept of entanglement. I mean, I know you can't apply quantum physics to large, big objects like us, but there is an argument to say that if you spend a time with somebody. Like, for instance, a mother carries a child for 9 months in its womb. So therefore, they will become entangled in some way, and therefore there's the knowledge and the proximity there as well. So there's some kind of linking here as well. You just know when somebody you love is in trouble.
Yeah, and there's lots of recorded instances where twins, for example, will know when their other twin has just had an accident, or known when they've died or something like that. And I think that basically, if you live in a reductionist world, your ability to see the things that are in front of you and a blaringly obvious becomes reduced. You know?
That's the point I think Tom was making before. You know, the idea, if you live in a world that you don't believe in these things, they won't occur in your worldview.
And we'll be right back. Man, it's been a really good hour. And we've got another one coming up. Back in a minute. Welcome back. Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. The first hour just went whew, like we're in a time warp of some kind. It is actually probably measurable, though. But again, this actually goes back to the thing. You can sit there and you can think that time's passed by or things have happened that are impossible, but if you've got a recording device or something like that going, it doesn't work. Right, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's this right. Last hour didn't feel like an hour, but yet the clock says it, and so does the recording. Kind of like Jodie Foster in the movie Contact, dropping through the little portal and being gone for 14 hours when anybody else only saw a second, and it was a recording device that made it real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is true. There is a thing called the psi uncertainty principle, and basically what that says is that the system will let things happen that are non-objective, you know, in our causality. You beat the objective causality rat, but only if there's plausible deniability, a legal term, right? Only if there's plausible deniability. If there isn't any plausible deniability, then you're kind of discouraged, or the probability of those things happening, let's put it this way, starts to decrease. And why is that? Because if we all understood how this reality worked, we all realized that we could modify reality with our minds, then we would probably not like that. You know, it's sort of like that if you go to the coastal Africa, where there are people who will make you healthy or make you ill as long as you pay them, you know, money every week, you know, this sort of thing. It's very.
I thought they called that a metropolitan hospital.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, but there are those places where everybody understands that reality can be moved by mind, and often they're not very friendly places because we are people full of ego, full of fear, and we tend to want to bully or use whatever power we can to get what we want and keep it. And that's not a place. It's not a good idea to go there. So there is a kind of a, it's not really a part of the rule set, but it's more like company policy that you kind of discourage that sort of thing. So the plausible deniability is, that's
here's
just
another
the way
element.
It works.
The other element I want to inject here is this concept of fate or destiny. You know, you are meant to be here, you are meant to do this, or you're foredestined, or something of that nature. And you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of American Idol, okay? All these idiots come in there who can't freaking sing, who and the vast majority of them tell the these judges who later on abuse them and tell them to frack off. It's my fate, it's my destiny to be here and to win American Idol. And I'm just like, dude, look, it's not your fate. It's not your destiny. And even the people who went there who do wind up winning to them, you could say it's fate, you could say it's destiny, but I found that those concepts actually only really work in retrospect. Only once you've got there can you say that it's fate or it's destiny. You can't say it beforehand, because then if it doesn't happen, then the whole concept gets thrown out the window.
Well, you have all these alternate decisions in your life, don't you? All the time we're making so many decisions. And effectively, our life follows one course, and it could have followed so many others, that you have to believe that I'm here now because of a series of decisions I made. But effectively, I'm here now because of decisions my ancestors made as well. So the idea of does fate happen? Now, there is an interesting aside to this in that there has been experiments done in Germany where they've shown that the intention to do something is already, your brain has already made a decision to do something up to 6 seconds before you do it. Now, effectively, this causes profound difficulties with the idea of, do I have freedom of action? Or am I fated to do certain things in certain ways? Now, there was an English scientist called Marcus de Satoy that went to Germany to have a look at the guys that were doing these experiments. And he saw in his own brain, when they did an MRI scan, the way in which he was about to make a decision to grab something, which he thought he'd made completely arbitrarily. But his brain had already made the decision as to where he was going to go with his hand before he'd even thought about doing it. Now, this has profound implications, but only if we see time as being something in the future. Whereas, of course, as Tom will rightly say, you know, space is space. If there's nothing in space, there is no space. If there's nobody perceiving the flow of time, there is no flow of time. Everything is a subjective experience. And this is why we create our own reality in certain ways, if we can control the reality. It's like the way they discover subatomic particles. I was saying in the break that I think it was Richard Feynman or somebody that made the famous statement when they were actually trying to discover certain subatomic particles that they predicted would be there. They were there because they expected to find them there. And this is curious in itself. You know, they think there should be a subatomic particle at this point, and lo and behold, there is. So it's, again, evidence that we are in some way manipulating our own reality.
Anthony, there is a reason for why people physically react before they, say, consciously react. Mm-hmm. And that's been known for a long time. Started with LeBay, I think, who did experiments.
Kornhuber. Yeah.
And then, of course, they use that data to say, well, then it has to be a deterministic reality because here we are going off to do it before we even know it. So obviously our consciousness is not leading, it's following. But that's not the case. The way the consciousness reality works is because it's virtual, because you get a data stream, okay, your data comes very quickly. Okay, now think of you're playing with The Sims or World of Warcraft. What's that worst thing that always causes you problems? It's called video lag, right? Mm-hmm. Where you move your mouse to draw your sword and your character just stands there and doesn't move because it takes a long time before the signal gets into that server and moves your character. So it's video lag. And the same thing, the character does something and you don't see it until after it already happened, you know, some time ago. Video lag. Well, we have the same problem here. We've got this virtual reality, and there's one part of it that's really, really slow, and that's our bodies. Because our bodies work on this rule set, and it's mechanical, electrical, you know, tendons, pulling muscles, tensing across joints. You know, everything is very, very slow. It's a mechanical world there. So what do we do if we're consciousness to make this virtual reality work? We can't have things happening a few seconds after they're supposed to because we have this video lag. Well, we start the body going before, you know, things actually happen. In other words, everybody raise your arm when the bell rings, and you'll find that if you look at these tiny little potentials, arms start to raise. Now, they don't show any motion, but the process, the tiny little electromechanical processes going on in the muscle start to energize to raise the hand before the bell was ever rung. You see? Why is that? Otherwise, the bell would ring, and then we'd all sit around, and, a little bit later, we'd put our hands up. There'd be this video lag that's a problem. So the way the virtual reality is run is that it starts these slow mechanical electrical processes going early before they're really needed. Now, let's say the person changes their mind They thought they were going to do this, and then they changed their mind. Well, it starts process A, and then in the middle, it's got to change and start process B. And what does that do? It makes people who are not sure of themselves, who change their mind a lot, clumsy. All right? So take somebody and put them 50 feet in the air on a 2x6. Let them walk across it. Now, anybody can walk across a 2x6 if it's laying on the ground. No problem. Put it 50 feet in the air, and most people will fall off before they get to the other end because they're hesitant. They're not steady. They don't know that they can do this. They're frightened. And what happens is these physical processes start, stop, change, change again, change, and it makes them really, really clumsy. Now, look at the athletes who are really good. What do? They'll tell you 80% of their game is mental. They have to see it. They have to have the whole process worked out in their head, and then their body just flows through it. You see? So that's how those things work. A good shot, whether it's an archer or a rifleman, they'll tell you that it's not as much a physical game. Everybody can point the gun and squeeze the trigger as it is a mental game. You have to be really focused on what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. If you have that focus that's really steady, everything works smoothly. If you don't, everything works kind of jerkily. You see, it doesn't work very smoothly. So that's what they're measuring from LeBay all the way up to these things. You know, they're measuring these tiny little processes. When you say that they started to move before, you know, they got the signal to move, well, that's only in these micro processes going on inside muscle tissue is where the motion's starting. That's what they're measuring. They're not measuring that the arm started to actually move up before the bell rang. They're saying that the electrochemical processes start before the bell rang. The arm doesn't move till afterwards.
Couldn't we just put that into anticipation? Like they know the bell's going to ring, so their muscles tense up in preparation for it?
No, they actually see that it actually starts to move. In other words, there's certain electrochemical things. It's not just preparation. Preparation is one state, but then they actually see that, you know, electrical charges start transporting from, you know, one side to the other. You know, this is in preparation for the movement. It has to happen. If you're going to move, these processes have to happen. If you're not going to move, if you're just anticipating, they don't happen. But down at this micro level, the biochemistry starts functioning before, you know, the requirement to function, and it's just part of the system's ability. It's part of the system's way of eliminating video lag in this virtual reality.
There's a wonderful example of that, Tom. I don't know if you're aware of the Dean Radin and Dick Bierman experiments that took place. I think it was probably about 2004. And what they did was they took a group of individuals and placed them in a room with a projector. And the projector was going to be projecting a series of photographs, some of which were very relaxing, like kittens and sunsets. But interspersed in these photographs were really horrific images of car crashes and things. And what they did was they actually placed a sensor on the skin of these individuals. And the sensor could tell when the skin changed. It's something electrolysis of the skin or something. And you do that when you're worried or when you're frightened. And they found that consistently, that the person would know, that the skin would react before the person had seen the image on the screen. And this was consistent. And they came to the conclusion this was because either they could anticipate or your mind could know the contents of your immediate future, or it could be something a lot more simple than that called a gambler's fallacy, which is the idea that if you're playing a game, say roulette, and it keeps coming up black, and every time it comes up black, the more times it comes up black, you'll believe the next time will be red. So if you see a lot of these individuals saw a series of pictures that were nice, every picture that they saw was nice, they know the next one is more likely to be a nasty one by statistics, and they'd react that way. But suffice to say, this again very much supports Tom's hypothesis there. So, you know, again, we have this idea of the rendering. And again, that is very, very persuasive to me. Yeah.
And it's not only that they were just showing these different kinds of pictures, but the picture themselves were randomly being selected by a computer. So the computer would go into a random number, and from that random number, it would generate, say, one of 300 pictures. So the people were actually starting to respond to the picture before the random number was chosen to select the picture. And I don't think it happened like most of the time, but with some people, it happened pretty, you know, it was almost a sure thing. They would always show the response when the ugly picture, you know, came up. So I don't think it's anticipation. I wouldn't think that it's the gambler's fallacy going on there, because that should, you know, that should miss almost as much as it hits. If you just anticipate and say, well, I haven't had a bad one for a while, so it's about time. But you can fix that by making, equals numbers of bad ones, if you like, or something else. That's kind of, you can experimentally take, you know, get rid of that variable. But these people were starting to move even before the picture had been selected by the computer. And that's because the computer, it's a virtual computer, right?
It's computer a, in a computer, you know, reality,
it's a virtual computer. The larger consciousness system knows what's coming next. That random number generator isn't really random. It's a part of a part of a sequence. You pick a seed and then you get a sequence of random numbers. It's not like, you know, it's a truly random thing. Computers don't generally do truly random things. That's hard to create, true randomness. It's that's a lot more difficult. So it's just a video lag problem that the system had to solve. Otherwise, it has this huge virtual reality going, and there's going to be video lag because you've got these real clunky human bodies following a rule set that requires, you know, levers and that kind of thing to make them go. You know, you got to squirt out a little hormone there, which sends a chemical signal someplace else, which has to travel through the blood and get to the brain and tell the brain to do something. And all of that takes a lot of time compared to the signals. Consciousness to consciousness is pretty well instantaneous. So it's a simple problem that needed a solution.
Now, speaking of simple problems that need solutions, I remember I was having a conversation with Alan Abadesa Green. I don't know if you know of him, but he was talking about how, look, I was sitting down and I wanted to move a chair to the other side of my apartment, and I thought about it for a second. Now, I've got two choices here. Number one, I can get up and move the chair. Take me 2 seconds. Or two, I can go and be a monk for 60 years and learn how to move the chair with my mind. And it just gets to the point where you realize that just simply doing things the really simple, straightforward way seems to be the most effective, and you get the most accomplished. Do you believe in that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, we're here for a reason, and that reason is to interact and be here. We're not here to get out of here. That's not really what we're here for. You know, we're here to experience, to be, to interact, to make choices, exercise that free will, to evolve our consciousness. That's what we're here for. This is a consciousness evolution trainer. It's a virtual reality trainer that we're in. So that's what's going on. And the idea that, well, you're here, what you need to do is to get out of here. You know, get in your mind and go take a trip, you know, spend all your time out of body or meditating or whatever. Then you're missing the whole point of being here. So yes, I agree with you. You know, that's not a good idea. You need to let that stuff go. It's good to understand. But look, this is life. This is what you're supposed to be doing. So pay attention. You know, it's that sort of thing. Go move the chair. You know, that's what you're supposed to do. Maybe you'll learn something.
Yeah. As Qui-Gon Jinn said to the young Jedi, don't draw upon your anxieties, Obi-Wan. Keep your concentration here and now where it belongs. But Master Yoda told me to be mindful of the future, but not at the expense of the moment. Be mindful of the living force, young Padawan. Yes, Master. We'll be right back after the break with Anthony Peake and Thomas Campbell at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Crossed desert bear, man. I breathe the mountain air, man.
Welcome back.
I had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the show that goes everywhere, man, because, well, basically, I am a very flippant individual and very curious, like a kitten, and I'm sure, pretty sure it'll kill me like someday. But in the meantime, I get to enjoy lots of different, very interesting and, conversely, unpredictable things. And this is why I encourage people, if you're going to listen to this show, if you're listening to the show on a delayed broadcast at some day or some point, you know, on YouTube or whatever, understand something. If you listen to this show every day, and I don't want to sound arrogant here, you will learn quantitatively more than you can from any other viewing material because it is so varied, so wide in its scope. And the quality of the guests that we have on this show is basically also quite varied. We go from the best of the best of the best to people you've never even heard of who are still very interesting anyway. So I'm going to encourage people, and this has been supported by many listeners to this show who have said to me they've learned more in 6 months listening to this show than they have in the last 15 years of their own personal research, listening to other people's shows and watching documentaries and things like that. It's because of that fact. Wake up. Keep listening to this show. You will learn something very valuable every day. Especially from my very special guest. In fact, this has been an awesome interview. Anthony Peak and Thomas Campbell. Now, you guys have websites, don't you?
Yes.
Plug them, because this show's kind of like a bathtub. Doesn't work very well without a plug.
Well, go ahead, Anthony. I'll do mine after yours.
There's no answer to that, Tom. Right, okay, my website is www.anthonypeake.com. That's Anthony with an H and Peak, P-E-A-K-E, similar spelling to my great-uncle Mervyn. I'm also on Facebook and very, very active on Facebook as well. So if you just look up Anthony Peak, you'll find me on here as well. In fact, I'm keeping an eye on what's happening on Facebook as we're doing it on this super-duper screen I've got.
Tom?
Okay. Yeah, I have a website that's www.mybigtoe.com. And also, you can go to YouTube. And if you go there, you just go for Tom Campbell or My Big Toe or put in TWCJR44 and you'll get my YouTube site. And on my YouTube site, every time I go out and do a conference, a talk, answer questions or workshops, it all ends up on YouTube. Everything I do is put up on YouTube for free. And if you want to read my books but don't want to pay for them, you can go to Google Books because they're there for free. Downside is you'll have to read them from a computer screen, but they're there just the same. Now, you can order books at my website or you could order books at, usual sources, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all other places in your neighborhood-friendly bookstore. But one other, and that is www.mbtevents.com. And those are the people that run that site that basically organize my time, tell me, where to go and when to be there. It's always nice to have somebody to tell you where to go that's a friend of yours. So,
yeah.
So anyway, those are the sites if you want to know more about it. Just Google my name or Google My Big Toe. My Big Toe is the names of the trilogy I wrote, the book. So any one of those and my sites will come up.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to shift gears here a little bit and talk about Philip K. Dick, one of my Facebook followers asked these guys about Philip K. Dick, and I said, I don't think it's appropriate to be talking about his experience with that, but if there is anything that's very interesting, because I've heard a number of things about this guy. Number one, he was really quite into his methamphetamine and was capable of producing numbers of full novels, like per year. Just on the burns, getting it down, and just pumping out all this material. The man's a prolific author, and there was one incident that I thought was very interesting. He, in one of his books, he had a character that walked into a convenience store to buy some milk, and it turned out that the person at the convenience store there who's buying the milk off was like his cousin or something like that. And a couple of years later, Philip K. Dick walks into a convenience store, buys a bottle of milk, starts up a conversation with the guy behind the counter, and it turns out that that man was his cousin. This is very interesting.
Philip K. Dick was an extremely fascinating guy, and I'm in the process of researching and writing my seventh book at the moment. And one of my UK publishers said, we'd like you to write a new biography of Philip K. Dick. And over the last 6 months, I've read virtually everything that's ever been written by him. I've read every single biography, every article. I've read all his letters and everything else. And I find him an absolutely intriguing character. It does seem that at times he was precognitive. That's quite clear. It seems that he had a series of profoundly deep and meaningful experiences in his life. He called it 2374, which happened in February and March of 1974, when he claimed that he had manifested within himself another element of himself. He also started to believe that time was orthogonal, as he called it, which effectively meant that there's a time that runs horizontal from this time, and he believed that we were all living within the Roman Empire still, in 70 AD. There were very many, many strange things that happened to him, and what I'm trying to discover is the background to these things, and I'm trying to do the neurology to try and find out if there are any neurological areas that we could actually understand exactly what happened to him, because his books are intriguing. You know, if anybody's read any Philip K. Dick books, you will find them to be the most wonderful, mind-blowing and mind-expanding experiences. And this is because he was writing from his own experiences. He wasn't writing necessarily fiction. He was embroidering his own experiences in a fictional way. And all his books after his experience in 74, books like Valis and The Divine Invasion, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, were all books based upon the things that happened to him and him trying to understand what happened to him. He's a fascinating guy, and I'm living his life at the moment. That's all I'm doing, is reading about Philip K. Dick and reading his letters. So sometimes I was at a Society of Authors meeting today, and I was trying to explain to the people that when you write a biography of somebody, you almost become them, because you start to think like them and everything. It's quite strange, quite strange experience.
Mm-hmm. Tom, have you had any experiences with him?
No, I have not. Don't have anything to add on that, although I've had plenty of precognitive experiences. The things you mentioned, those are not rare. You know, a lot of people have precognitive experiences. That's just, again, the future is probabilistic. And some things in the future are very probable, even pretty far out, so that you can make good predictions. And other things can be nudged, if you will, by the system to occur, because it's just probability, and people modify it as they go. So, yeah, precognition is a pretty common experience in the population.
Well, we had a discussion yesterday about how sci-fi movies, comics, and things of that nature, and in fact have really predicted things, like the way things are going to go, or have maybe given inspiration for new inventions that are coming out, like the Gene Roddenberry Star Trek kind of thing, where they had the little hand communication devices that later on came true as cell phones, you know, that kind of thing. And I was wondering exactly what the bridge is between precognition, artistic inspiration, and manifesting it within reality.
Yeah, they're all related, obviously. I mean, sometimes it's just good guessing. You think, what would I really like? Sure would be neat if you just had a phone I could pull out of my pocket, you know, and talk to somebody. So you put that in your show because that just seems like a really good thing. And if it's something that's a really good thing, which means it's very marketable and people can make a lot of money, then it's got a pretty high probability, you know, of coming about if it's technically feasible, you know, if it actually can be done. So you have that, plus you have people get their inspiration often from this larger consciousness system. And you'll find that not only in the arts, not only the people who write and paint, that they kind of get in that state, which is sort of a meditation state, but, you know, eyes open, whatever. And once they're in that state is where their inspiration comes from. It doesn't come from their intellects. It comes more from their intuition. And scientists are the same way. You know, you read some of Albert Einstein's, biography, and a lot of his ideas came to him, you know. Not because he beat them out of the mathematics with his intellect, but because he relaxed, opened up his mind, and it just dropped in, you know. So lots of stories. You talk of movies. How about The Matrix? You know, lots of stories have kind of paved the way for our thinking about reality, because we do get this stuff out of the future probable database. We are connected to all these things. We just don't know that we are. It's not through our intellect. That's not where the connection is. So there is a tight connection with, you know, these things that happen, why they happen, how it is that the art seems to imitate real life before real life, actually gets there. It's all very intertwined, entangled, as Anthony might say. You know, it's all connected in very interesting and generally very productive ways.
Well, it's intriguing, though, that you mention The Matrix, because the Wachowski brothers, who directed and wrote The Matrix, very much said that they were very much influenced by Philip K. Dick and Philip K. Dick's writings. And, of course, there's been so many movies based upon Philip K. Dick's work anyway, you know, from Total Recall.
Minority Report,
again, and Blade Runner is the classic, which was based upon Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, or very loosely based upon that. But one of the things that intrigued me about Phil was... one of the most amazing precognitions he had is absolutely evidenced because it's from a dated letter. And in about 1975 or 76, I think, he wrote a letter to a pen pal called Claudia Bush, or Claudia Krenz Bush. And in the letter, and I've got one of the copies of this letter, he says that a couple of nights ago, I had a very, very strong hypnagogic image. Now, hypnagogic imagery is that when you're in that kind of liminal, half asleep, half awake state, what Tom was talking about just before, about where creativity comes from. And while he was in this liminal state, he had an image of a man lying face down between a coffee table and a settee, or an armchair. And he said, I just had a terrible feeling about this image I saw. In 1982, in March of 1982, Phil hadn't turned up for a regular meeting he used to have with a group of friends of his, people like Tim Powers, etc. And he didn't turn up. So they sent somebody round to the house, and they couldn't get in. So the group got together, and they opened the door, and they found Phil lying flat face down between a settee and his coffee table. Now, that to me is amazing, because there we had an image of him seeing in a hypnagogic state his own death scenario, because although he wasn't dead at the time, he had a massive stroke, and he died about 4 or 5 days later. Now, that intrigued me, because that is absolutely a provable fact, because the letter is in existence and it's dated. Now, that's intriguing to me. And again, as Tom would say, perfectly explicable within my big toe.
Mm-hmm. And exactly how did you come up with the term my big toe? What is this to do with?
Well, toe, of course, is a acronym in the physics community. Stands for theory of everything. Einstein started that acronym. He was doing a thing called unified field theory. The idea was that quantum mechanics and relativity, though both very successful, each one denied a fundamental premise of the other, you see. So scientists knew at the time there's something else. You know, these two are subsets of something bigger. So they went on this search for, you know, the theory of everything, which would be something that you could derive both quantum mechanics and relativity from, kind of the superset, if you will. And that's where it started. So it's called a toe, a theory of everything. Now, my big toe, I called it that because there's something that that I tell everybody, and that is that if it's not your experience, it can't be your truth. So because this is mine, this is my big toe, I don't want you to believe it. That would be foolish. Belief is what gets people into trouble. Belief is a barrier that shuts you off. It makes you no longer open to new data. So by all means, I tell you, don't believe it. But I give you plenty of hints and instructions on how to go experience it to make it your own truth. So it's my big toe. That's why.
All right. I get it. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, ladies and gentlemen. Anthony Peake from anthonypeake.com and Thomas Campbell from mybigtoe.com. Final segment right after the break, ladies and gentlemen.
Bonkers.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that is just a little bit bonkers. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I don't know. I feel free to be silly and break from conventions and break from rules. Rules are made to be broken, and so are arms and legs and various other things. And you know what the thing that really occurs to me is your life path and where you think you're going to be and who you think you're going to turn into is really a interesting road of broken dreams that you pick up the pieces and you create something new entirely. It's probably a lot better than how you originally envisioned yourself turning out. You know, you don't wind up being a fireman or an astronaut or something like that. You become somebody completely different from who you thought you were as a child, as your experiences kind of come on to you and sort of force you in a different direction, whether or not you like it. And I do believe that suffering, really, trauma, things of this nature are the things that really shape you and break you and give you those little pieces that are smashed to build something much better. Anthony Peake and Thomas Campbell are my guests, and we were talking over the break about how, you know, we've only got 12 minutes left or something like that, and what the hell are we talk about, you know? We've got Anthony Peake and Thomas Campbell, jeepers, creepers, what the heck can we put into this inside of around about 10 minutes? And they were like, well, Vinny, it's your show, you know, we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about. And I go, no, it's my show, and I want you to talk about what you want to talk about.
So what I'd like to talk about, funnily enough, very quickly, is something I was talking about offline again, was the coincidence of Tom's concept of my big toe, in the sense that my concept of my own ideas, my own hypothesis, I also call big toe, which is quite strange, and mine is the Bohmian IMAX grand theory of everything, which I do not have time to go into detail here. But I find it quite curious that both of us, quite coincidentally, have come up with the same acronym. I can understand the toe side of things, but the big is very, very strange. And you wonder if, again, there was some kind of plan to get us together. And Vinny, here we are now, our whole lives have been drawn together as a series of coincidences and collapsing wave functions in order to get Tom and I talking to you this beautiful evening in February.
Well, in actual fact, it's not collapsing, it's collaboration, because Ghulam, Jacques, I think, I don't even know his name, he's French, and he's the one who organized this entire week of guests, and I want to give him a big ups, because we've had some really fantastic guests, and the week is not yet over. And he was on a call with me and our mutual contact, Alan Eberdesser-Green. I believe you've written a section for him on the Sync book, and I'm going to be interviewing yes. him or vice versa soon. And he wanted to help me because I've always, you know, doing lots and lots of stuff. And he wanted to help me by organizing a week full of guests. So it's just one thing leading to another, leading to another, leading to another. And what I find is if you're a good person, you know, like I believe that I am, I could be wrong, you know, maybe I'll have some kind of realization that I'm actually some kind of a-hole. But if you're a good person and you try to do good things for other people, yeah, good things happen.
Yeah.
There's no mystery.
Probably the case. Yeah, yeah,
that's the way it works. That's part of the way we make our own reality. You know, you create that. You create those good things happening. The synchronicity, you know, has a process to it. It's not just random. You create those sorts of things because of your attitudes, because of your intents. When you give, you get back. If what you're interested in is getting, then getting is very difficult. You know, the thing you said earlier about pain and misery, it's unfortunate, but it seems that pain is a much better teacher than feeling good. When we're feeling good, we just kind of kick back and everything's fine, and it's like, don't change anything because it's good now. But when we get that pain, you start looking for things to change, looking for ways to be different or do it different. So that's the unfortunate truth for us, is that we learn through pain, and we don't learn much if we don't have any pain.
Yeah, and this is why I was just thinking these last couple of days. You know how these people who work in an office building for like 30, 40 years or 50 years or something like that, and they retire, they get a cheap gold watch, and they run, and they wonder what the hell they did with their life, and then they wind up going to university to become a doctor and study for 8 years while they're 65 years old or something like that, and by the time they get out, they get superannuation and they can't practice anyway. it's like, just wasted my freaking life. You know why you wasted your life, mate? Because you were spending all your time worrying about making things secure in your life when there was no real such thing. And not to mention, the only reason why you're capable of working in that office environment for so freaking long without actually wanting to leave and actually really doing something about it is because there was only slight frustrations and slight irritations and things like that in your life. If your boss had been a complete psychopath or something like that, if your employees or if your fellow employees had ostracized you or treated you terribly or something like that, you would have gotten the heck out of there. You would have learned something. You would have changed something. You would have made your life better, but you didn't. And I think that's what we really need to recognize about how our life really works, is that if you really want something, don't wait for things to get really bad before you go about changing them or trying to figure them out or being curious about them. You know, constantly you've got to be learning, learning, learning. It's I forget who told it to me, but it's called being a perennial student. And I hold that belief to be really true, because the brain has such a capacity for learning things and figuring things out, problem solving and what have you, that you could literally be learning things from the first day of your life to the last day of your life, and you'd still know only a fraction of the knowledge that is out there.
Totally.
Don't waste your time.
I mean, I was very much intrigued, again, what Tom was saying before about creativity and the way in which we have this amazing capacity to learn new things. And I found, you know, as I've got older, that my brain should be slowing down now, and it doesn't seem to be. My brain seems to be more effective now than it was in my 20s and my 30s. And it's because I'm interested in what I'm doing, and because it drives me more than anything else, than ever anything in my life. I mean, I don't earn a great deal of money from my writing, but what I do find is now is that, to use the Abraham Maslow idea, I'm self-actualized. In fact, literally, to make a pun, I'm experiencing my own peak experience. And anybody knows that Maslow's hierarchy of needs will get that pun as well. But effectively, in my book, The Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self, it's again one of the areas I look into is creativity and how, where this creativity comes from, where we get this information from. And why it is some people have a great need to understand and learn, and other people just don't seem to be interested. And I do find that amazing as to why people aren't open to the... Life is an experience to learn and to understand. Other people just want to vegetate, and I don't understand why. I don't find it very sad.
Maybe it's because you know the difference. And again, this goes back to the suffering, you know, and learning the lessons of it. Sorry, Thomas, go ahead.
That's all right. I was going to say, we have free will, and we are the sum of our choices. All the choices we've made are going to lead us to where we are today. But to not do anything is also a choice. So that is that's your free will to make that choice. Unfortunately, you know, we have two kind of truisms I'm sure we've all heard before, and one is that you don't really know what you don't know. You know, the more you learn, the more you realize that you don't really know a whole lot, you know, that there's so much more to learn. But the other side of that coin is the more that you learn, the easier it is to learn more. So it's an accelerating process. The more you learn, the easier it is to learn more, and then you learn more. So it's a snowball rolling downhill. So like Anthony says, it's not that you end up, in your 60s and you're brain dead. Is that you end up in your 60s and that ball's still rolling. You know, you're still able to learn more quickly than, you know, if you have been learning all along, and if you've been sitting in an office, you know, watching, you know, your toenails grow or something, then you can't learn a whole lot later in life because learning isn't part of what you do. You know, what you do is kind of sit around and get by. And for those people, you know, life is tedious. And
Tom, is that the My Big Toenail then?
Yes. The big toenail parable, and I think it's like if you use it or lose it sort of thing. Like if you don't use your muscles, they start to atrophy, and I think that the same is true of your brain. If you don't use it, it starts to get more and more pathetic. You know, you can gain its strength back if you really work out and try and stretch it and that kind of thing, just like a muscle, but. If you don't do it, if you don't get off the couch, you're still going to be fat and lazy and eating potato chips and not getting anywhere.
Yeah. See, there's this thing, I don't know if you remember from your high school science, a thing called Brownian motion. That's where a lot of particles bump into each other. So a bunch of particles in a jar, they all move randomly because they're all bumping into each other. Well, we have a thing sort of called, that I call social Brownian motion. We make these choices. But people will tell you, well, just nothing ever interesting happened to me. You know, I never had the kind of opportunities, you know, that other people had. Well, that's just not true. It's what you make of it. You're bumping into other people. Not only are you making choices and having to learn and grow or not based on those choices, but so are all the people around you. And you're all bumping into each other. And those bumps change you. Make a difference. You know, like you said, what you thought you wanted to be when you were six, the fireman or the policeman or the airplane pilot, most of the time doesn't work out. What job do you have? Well, it's not because you planned for it and went out and got it. Most of the time, it's because you happen to be at the right place at the right time with the right attitude and the right needs, and it just went together. So that's why you're a doctor or an Indian, you know, or, you know, whatever, a mechanic. Because that's where you were when that choice was needed to be made. So there's lots of opportunity, lots of randomness. The pot's always being stirred, and all we have to do is take advantage of it, make good choices.
That's right. And I think when you're taking advantage and you're making good choices, the thing that you'll notice is that from one day to the next, from one year to the next, you don't recognize the person you were. Because the change in yourself is so rapid in its evolution that you just kind of stop looking back and you start looking forward. Anthony, Thomas, thank you very much for coming on the show today. It's been a very, very great pleasure and various other nice adjectives. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been great fun. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Vinny. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Assured.